No, I'm really enjoying the book. It's one of these books that it's very hard to put down.
Well, I hope so. It's meant to be that way.
Yeah, you just there's one crisis after another, and the suspense just keeps building and building and building. So, let's talk a little bit about. Let's talk a little bit about you before we go into the novel, as you've had. Quite a past as a journalist and a correspondent. So give me a little background about yourself. I know you were born in Connecticut and you went to Yale, and it seems almost improbable that someone from Yale would wind up being a news correspondent. That doesn't happen. You're supposed to go into banking.
Well, that's exactly right. And particularly I hate to say, distant time when I left the Ivy Halls. And in point of fact, I did not go into newspaper. I wanted to go newspaper work, you know. But it was a very unfashionable and, above all, underpaid occupation in those days.
It still is.
It still is, yeah. But not the way it used to be, let me tell you. And I suppressed this urge, and I decided that I would go into commerce and industry. So I went to work for Procter & Gamble out in Cincinnati, Ohio, peddling or advertising soap.
That was the pre-news correspondent days.
That was the pre-news correspondent days, pre-Army days. And I was inducted into the Army in 1953 and was assigned to different public relations tasks, finally. And I wound up in Paris working at Shape headquarters as a public relations assistant, writing stories about our wonderful inter-allied cooperation. And I came back. It's very funny. This really reawakened my desire to be a newspaper man. And I looked for a job in Paris when I was ready to take my discharge. Couldn't find one. Came back. I spent a month combing the Eastern Seaboard, looking, begging for a job in newspaper work. New York Times, Newsweek, Time, everybody, nothing. And finally, I was offered a job writing picture captions for the old INP, the old news service. And I took it on a Friday morning. I put a letter of resignation to Procter & Gamble into the mail.
Now, wait a minute. INP?
INP, International News Photos. They had long since disappeared and were merged with UP. It's the I in UPI.
But that was affiliated with
Hearst,
INS at one time.
That's right. It was INS's
picture arm.
Picture arm. Mm-hmm. So I took this job, and they sat me down next to this old Irish drunk who had been writing picture captions for 35 years, and his breath would curdle milk at 10 feet.
I used to work with that guy here when the. Because later he got a job with the Trib, and when that folded, he came here and you
worked with him.
Yeah, he found it was very difficult to write radio news after writing captions for a newspaper.
I'll bet he did. And I said to myself, by God, you have made the most disastrous mistake in your life, and I quit. And they said, you can't quit. You just started working. Never mind, I quit. And I got on the plane, went out to Cincinnati, and on Monday morning, I went into work. Early, for the first time, I think, in my advertising career at Procter & Gamble.
Now, wait a minute. It just happened like that, overnight?
Overnight. I put the letter of resignation in the mail already. So I got there, and I went to my boss's secretary, and I said, listen, Carol, there's a letter coming in the mail to Ed, and I've changed my mind about some of the things in there. Will you please get the letter out of his inbox and give it to me? And she did, and I went back to work for them, and I stayed there another 6 months. But increasingly, this desire to become a newspaper man overtook me, and finally, I was offered a job at a slave's wage with the Paris Bureau of the United Press. And I got on a boat and went and took it, and have never regretted having done so.
Oh, and what a terrific way for you to do your homework, lay your groundwork for the books that you've written.
I think that's very true. I think all newspaper men dream one day of writing books. And I think that, by and large, there is no better preparation or training for one day writing, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, than the newspapering experience.
And yet, it's said that the newspaper experience, or the journalist experience, is the kiss of death for someone who wants to be a writer. There are, outside of yourself and a few other people, William Kennedy won the Pulitzer Prize for fiction last year. He's been a newspaper man most of his career. But William McPherson also, I think he won the year before a National Book Critics Circle Award for a well-received first novel. He works for the Washington Post. It's called Testing the Current. And outside of yourself and a couple of others, there are not that many journalists who actually write fiction, are there?
Well, I think if you look back, you will find that most novelists at one stage or another in their lives have served an apprenticeship as newspapermen. You know, Hemingway, we think of Hemingway strictly as a novelist, but in fact, one of the best books that I've read under his name was a collection of his dispatches as a correspondent for that paper in Toronto, the Globe, I think, or the Star. And I think if you move for Irwin Shaw, well, Irwin Shaw wrote from time to time for Stars and Stripes. He really went directly out of Brooklyn College and began to write for a radio program. Jimmy Jones, from Here to Eternity, never wrote in a newspaper. It was never a newspaperman, nor was Norman Mailer. But I think if you look through the list of people in the last four decades who have been reasonably successful novelists, you will find a striking proportion who had some newspaper experience at some time. I mean, it first of all exposes you to so many things. Newspaper men are voyeurs, really, into the tragedies of others. And I suppose in some ways it's one of the disagreeable aspects of the profession, because you're always watching, looking at other people suffer or other people's miseries, whether it's a wife whose husband has just been murdered in a mugging, or whether it's five members of a Shiite Muslim militia who are involved in hijacking people. But this does also expose you to a wide range of human emotion and how people react to those emotions.
Frederick Forsyth, another example.
Oh, yeah. Freddie was a friend of mine in Paris.
I'm not sure about Le Carré, though. I'm not sure what
he... No, John Le Carré was an intelligent... His real name is Cornwall, and he was a member of British intelligence.
You spent much of your career then in Paris.
Yes. Yes, I did. I went there first as a GI in 1954. And I must say, when I got off that train at the Gare du Nord, I literally couldn't, despite my Yale education, order scrambled eggs in French. But I fell in love with the city. I think Paris, if you fall in love with it at a certain stage in your life, is like the woman with whom you've lost your virginity. You will never forget her. And I never did forget Paris, and I can tell you that when I got back to Cincinnati, all I could think of was getting back to Paris, and I more or less tended to come back there ever since. Yes.
Did you know James Jones?
I knew Jimmy very well. Jimmy had a poker game. It was the Sunday night poker game at Jimmy's house, which he had inherited from Art Buchwald. And we would gather there regularly, a group of seven of us who were more or less regular players, and his wife Gloria would make spaghetti, and we'd play poker. He was a wonderful man, absolutely marvelous guy. A man who had an almost unhealthy honesty in devotion to his craft. And second, who was extremely engaging as a friend. I mean, you just couldn't be bored being out with Jimmy Jones.
I knew him a little bit when he came back to live on Long Island. And, I mean, I wasn't really a friend, a little bit, you know, as an interviewer. But he was that way, and he was the kind of guy you wanted to pack up and take home with you.
Oh, yeah, he was great. He used to have, he had a kind of a pulpit that had, I think he'd probably gotten it in an antique market, and it originally came from a church. He lived on the Ile Saint-Louis, and this was stuck in one corner of his rooms, and that his parties tended to get rather heavily into the sauce, and then a lot of shouting and arguing about whatever was the conversation of the day. And if you started to shout a little bit too loud, Jimmy would put you up in the pulpit, and you'd have to stand up there and give your speech and then answer the attacks from the audience down below.
J.P. Miller, did you know J.P. Miller? He also lived in Paris. And he was also a friend of James Jones, and he tells this wonderful story that I can't duplicate very well, but I think you'll like it. James Jones, at one of his parties, apparently overindulged, as I guess was a frequent occurrence for James Jones, and got into a dispute with someone else. I can't remember who it was. It was someone fairly well known. So they went down to the street to exchange fist, and Jones was a little bit drunk, and the other guy just bopped him in the nose, you know, and Jones fell down, his nose bleeding, and he staggers back up, and he says to his assailant, he says, "And don't you ever do that again."
I think I have heard that story, as a matter of fact. Yeah.
Maybe,
yeah.
Maybe it's not a true story. Maybe
no,
it's just one.
It probably is. Jimmy was a very tough guy.
Well, you went on from UPI to Newsweek, and how long were you with Newsweek?
I was with them from 1959. I joined them in Beirut in April 1959. I reopened. They had closed their Middle Eastern bureau, and I reopened it for them. And they moved me to Paris in 1961, and I left them at the end of 64.
Mm. Your first book, 1964.
That's right. It's Paris Burning. I left them just after that.
How did you develop the relationship you had with your co-author?
Well, I met Dominique when I was in Paris doing my military service. I was stationed at Shape headquarters, which in those days was just outside of Paris. It's the military arm of the North Atlantic Alliance. He was serving his time in the French Army, and I was there. There was a group of friends, Franco-American largely. Bob Silvers, who's the editor of the New York Review of Books, was a member of it. Dominique and I became very good friends. And the day that I left to come back home and take my discharge, you're never sad to get out of the army, but I was rather sad to leave Paris. And I went down to say goodbye to the girl that I've been going with, and then Dominique and his wife took me out and put me on the train to come back to Bremen and then back to the United States. And as we were walking along that quay to get in the car, his wife said to me, we've just learned 2 days ago that I'm pregnant, and I'm expecting a child in November, and we would like very much to ask you to become the godfather of that child. And I was terribly touched because, quite frankly, I thought at that moment that I would perhaps return to Paris for a two-week vacation as a middle-aged businessman and not again. And this, in a sense, gave me kind of a reason to come back, and I accepted with alacrity and joy. And in fact, I did come back a year later, and Dominique was there working for Parimatch. And we resumed our friendship and would occasionally be competing against each other in the years that followed. There was one instant when I stole some photographs that he wanted, and he was over the moon in fury about it. And then I returned to Paris to take the Newsweek Bureau in 1961. And he had, in the meantime, served in New York and in Moscow and was back in Paris with Match. And we wanted to do something together that one would allow us to take advantage of the fact that one of us was French and the other was American, and two, that might provide us a springboard away from journalism, because journalism is the greatest career in the world when you're young, but when you can't run anymore, it begins to pale on you a little bit. And we thought about doing a biography of André Malraux, and then we decided not to do that. And one day in my Newsweek office, I was going through the Observer of London on Monday morning, and I saw a little paragraph, literally a paragraph, which somehow referred to the German general who had received the orders from Hitler to blow up Paris in 1944. And that night, Dominique and his girlfriend came by my flat for a drink, and I said, I saw the damnedest thing in the paper today, this story about this German general who'd been told to blow up Paris. He said, oh, yeah, there were rumors about this. And all of a sudden, the light went on, and we said, listen, we're looking for something that's Franco-American. There was never in history an event that was more Franco-American by its very nature than the liberation of Paris. And off we went, and out of that came as Paris Burning, and we then had the opportunity to continue our collaboration, and so we did.
And you did Up Until Fall from Grace.
Exactly.
Every book you have done with your collaborator. What about the cultural differences? You're being American, because this is certainly a plus if you describe it in the way you have, finding a topic in which both Americans and French are involved. But you must have some language problems, cultural problems, in getting together to do this?
Well, we don't have language problems. Dominique has always been fluent in English.
So you've written exclusively in English?
Oh, no, he writes in French. I have become pretty much bilingual over the years. I wasn't when we first met, obviously, but Dominique went to high school in New Orleans. His father was appointed French Consul General in New Orleans right after the war, and he also had a Fulbright scholarship to Lafayette, so his English is very, very good. Mm-hmm. So there was never a linguistic problem, and the cultural differences were, an advantage, because it broadened each of our perspectives and horizons. That really didn't bother us. I think we did discover when we wrote The Fifth Horseman, which is also a novel, that it is indeed more difficult to write a novel in collaboration than to write works of nonfiction, which is one of the reasons why I decided to write Fall from Grace alone.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. The Fifth Horseman wonderful idea of Gaddafi getting the bomb. Here it is, a novel you've written previously for nonfiction books. That must have been a major transitional problem for you, huh?
It was in the beginning. You know, we did it for a couple of reasons. One, because we thought it was a very good idea. But second, because there is a certain part of the world that will say, well, okay, these guys have written good nonfiction books, but there's no writer who, until you write a novel, you're not a writer. So, and these guys will never be able to do it. So we wanted to, I think, address that challenge by trying to write a novel. In the beginning, it was difficult. I must say that as time has gone by, and increasingly with fall from grace, I think I've become somewhat infected by the virus, and I, in some ways, prefer now the novel form to nonfiction.
How did it feel writing your first book all by yourself? A little lonely.
Yeah, intimidating in the beginning, no doubt about it. The research was for this book was just marvelous fun. I had a great time doing it and loved every moment of it. And then, of course, you have to address yourself to the much more painful moment when you sit down and have to write the book. And it's true that it was intimidating in the beginning, but then I must say I really got to... I can't say that I enjoyed it, because I never enjoy writing, but I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. Or I enjoyed it. I suffered less than I thought that I was going to.
But you mentioned the research, and you must have done voluminous research in so many little tiny details that I became aware of, but didn't really hit me in the face. But as I began reading, I also began feeling that there must be a million of them in here. It's just objects on a table or a street scene or just a whole bunch of detail there that seemed to come so naturally, as if they were coming out of your mind, and yet I have this feeling that, no, this actually happened.
I would think that by and large is probably true. I
mean, the one minister, I can't remember who it was in the earlier chapters, referring to Churchill by his first name. I mean, nobody ever did that.
That's right, except in the, and that was Brooke, who was the chief of the Imperial General Staff. General Sir Alan Brooke, and he was one. Ismay also.
It's a small detail, but it's one of these things that seems to me to lend a lot of credibility to what you.
Yeah, mean. Yeah. I think that by and large, most of those details. For example, it's a small detail, which fascinated me when I discovered it. When these secret agents left England to go into occupied enemy territory, among the things that they were given at the moment of their departure was a cyanide pill, so that should they find themselves under Gestapo torture, they could deliver themselves from that torture if they felt it was unbearable. Now, by the very nature of things, most 50% of the agents going in were French, and therefore a certain number of them, a high percentage of them, were Roman Catholic. And they had obtained from the Archbishop of Westminster an official religious dispensation, so that for a Roman Catholic to take this pill under duress, and therefore to commit suicide, would not be considered by the Church as a mortal sin. That is a fact.
Thank goodness the Church comes through in a pinch. You, according to the publicity data that Simon and Schuster sent over, you have a... It's a very interesting story about how Fall from Grace came about, and it goes back to a dinner conversation you had with a very famous military figure.
Yes, let me say that the first grain of inspiration of this book came in 1972, and I was doing the research for Freedom at Midnight, which I wrote with Dominique, with Lord Louis Mountbatten, who was the last Viceroy of India, and who had been the commander of combined operations, which had developed many of the techniques and the material that we use in the invasion. And he was a wonderful man. I've got to say that I absolutely adored him. And among his most engaging traits was a total lack of modesty. And he spent about 15 minutes telling me how he had virtually assured the success of the invasion with all of the devices which he had developed. But then he said, "But despite all this, my dear Larry, I must tell you that the invasion would never have succeeded had we not managed to make the Germans swallow the greatest lie ever told. And it was really the result of the most Machiavellian, diabolical intelligence scheme in history. Well, I was intrigued. So I said, my goodness, you know, Lord Louis, what's all that? Tell me about it. And he said, oh, no, I won't tell you a thing. It's all absolutely secret and will remain secret for years and years to come. And I pushed and prodded and got nowhere. But finally he said, well, I'll tell you one thing. And that is that if you ever come upon the word fortitude, and if you do, it will be long after my death, you will know that you are on the trail of something absolutely remarkable. I did indeed come upon that word, and indeed it was after Lord Louis had died, killed by the IRA in Ireland. And it was that, I suppose, and I remembered this conversation, and in part of the reading that I've been doing, which led me to fortitude, was a character, a Frenchman, who is the inspiration for one of the characters in Fall from Grace. And this man held a job very similar to the one that I give to my imaginary character in Fall from Grace, who was in charge of all of these clandestine air operations when planes came in and found a farmer's field in the middle of occupied France and would land, deposit a couple of resistance and pick two or three up and go back to London. And in fact, one of the passengers on one of these little secret flights in November of 1943 was François Mitterrand, who is today the president of France. And I discovered that this man was at least a double agent, that he was in fact working for the Gestapo. And by one of these small coincidences of life, his radio operator at the time during the war happened to have been a very good friend of mine. He himself was dead. So those two things sort of set me off on the trail. That's how I began to move towards what eventually became Fall from Grace.
Well, I wonder if it's too much to ask, because we don't want to spoil the plot, of course, but the diabolical method by which the Allies set up the Nazis, I mean, is it all right to divulge that?
Yeah, and it's in a very general sense. Yes, look, the whole scheme, which was designed to fool the Germans when we landed in Normandy in 1944, was really indispensable to the success of those landings. The Germans had 60 divisions in France, Holland, and Belgium. Of those 60, 12 were Panzer divisions, and they were the best the Germans had, far better than anything that we had. We had, in England, 37 divisions, American, Canadian, and British. We had to transport them across 100 miles of open water, land them on a defended beach, and then make our foothold secure against the inevitable massive German counterattack. Now, if the Germans had used those forces properly and swiftly, there is no way the invasion could have succeeded. Therefore, it was essential to make them play the cards that they held in their hands wrong. And we did. And we did it through this remarkable example of what was called in those days deception and is now called disinformation. And it was to lead the Germans to believe that Normandy was a diversion, which we had created deliberately to provoke their reaction, i.e., to get them to commit their forces against it, and that once they'd done so, the real landing was going to strike them in the Pas-de-Calais. Now, the consequence, obviously, is if they believe this, they hold in the Pas-de-Calais those divisions which otherwise would have driven us right back into the English Channel. And that was the long and the short of it, and we did it. Now, the question of how we did it is infinitely more complex, more cunning, more diabolical, and does indeed involve doing certain things which we may find morally reprehensible or questionable, but which were perhaps necessary to the success of the overall plan.
Did it really happen?
The particular story, well, the success of this deception operation depended upon three things. The first two were double agents, that is to say, agents who the Germans thought were working for them, but who were in fact operating under Allied control. One was a Pole and one was a Spaniard. The third was a resistance network in northern France, which had been penetrated by the Gestapo, to whom we gave these famous alert and action code messages to be broadcast over the BBC, the first to alert them to the fact that great events were about to take place, and the second, these people were told, would mean that there would be a landing north of Calais 24 hours after that message was broadcast. The members of this network, and no one knows who they were, because you can only find their trace in the German archives, were arrested, were interrogated, which means tortured, and some or all of them revealed the messages and the interpretation which had been assigned them. Those messages were then in fact broadcast by the BBC on June 8th and June 9th. And their receipt by the Germans of those messages and the interpretation which they gave to them was vital in leading the Germans to fall into this fatal trap which cost them the war. What I have done in Fall from Grace is to put a face to those anonymous and unknown resistance who disappeared somewhere into what in those days was called the Nacht und Nebel, the night and the fog of Germany's concentration camps.
It's a real page-turner, Larry Collins. Are you still living in Paris? Or you have a couple of residences. Do you have a fixed address?
I have a couple of fixed addresses. I have one in the south of France, which I love very much, and I have a flat in London, and I have some property here in Lakeville, Connecticut. Both of my children are now in school back here in the United States, so I have considerably more reason to come back to this country now than I used to.
No hard feelings on the part of Dominique for striking out on your own?
Oh, no, not at all. No. No, I mean, when the book Fall from Grace came out first in France in February, and it did very well. In fact, it was the second time since the French have had bestseller lists that a novel written by an American was their number one bestseller. And the first question that I would get when I would be interviewed was, hey, why the divorce? And I would say, hey, look, it's not a divorce. It's an amicable separation and perhaps a temporary one.
This came out in France in February?
Yeah, French publishing is, it's like instant coffee. You know, you mix words and ink and you get a book. They began translating the book before I'd finished it. And they, in fact, began to set the translation into type before I had finished.
So the first edition actually came out way back then. Huh?
Yeah.
Well, you're certainly an engaging guy for a Yalie, and but since you went into journalism, you can't be all that.
That's true.
At least you're not any longer with Procter & Gamble, so that's...
And by the way, the footnote to that story that I told you earlier, when Is Paris Burning came out, I went back to Cincinnati, and a friend of mine gave me a cocktail party, and the guy to whom this letter had been addressed was there, and he was at the time the president of Procter & Gamble. And I told him the story, and you know something? He didn't laugh.
I can't understand that. Probably gave you a free container of toothpaste.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you very much for telling me about your origins and how Fall from Grace came about. And I really appreciate you coming in and chatting with me. I'm going to look forward to putting this together.
Don, I enjoyed it very much.